Hello and welcome to season 4 of Medical Women Talking. My name is Jane Dacre and I've been privileged to listen to the career stories of these inspiring colleagues. These women have all made an impact and many of them have overcome barriers in their careers. From them, you will learn that we all have setbacks and barriers in our careers, but what defines us is how we cope with this, which is part of life.
Talking to Dr. Ananta Dave. Ananta is a rare lady because she is a chief medical officer, of whom there are not very many women, and she works in the Black Country ICS. So Ananta, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jane, for inviting me.
So can we start off, as we normally do, is just having a chat about you and your career and where you've come from and just a sort of potted history of how you've got to where you are.
Thank you. Yes. So I was born in India and I lived there for 28 years of my life. So I started having dreams of becoming a doctor when I was fairly young, before I had taken my what were called board exams in India. So the equivalent of GCSEs and A-levels here. So around that time, I started dreaming of becoming a doctor. I think, young as I was, the thought of being able to do something which saved people's lives and brought them back literally from the dead, it appealed to me. So I had this idea and this dream, but I wasn't sure whether it would be possible or I would be successful. So right since then, I was determined that if I could, I would become a doctor. And I was the first person in my family, female in my family on either side, so my father's side and my mother's side, to go to university in India. So it was a big step and there were no doctors in my family. So it was stepping into the unknown. But I applied, I got through, and I've never regretted it, never looked back. I'm very proud to be a doctor.
Isn't it terribly competitive to get into medicine in India?
It
is. You have to be very academic, don't you?
Yes, it is very competitive. And the number of medical schools then were very few, actually. Now we have a combination of private and government-run medical schools. And, so there are many, although it's still very competitive, there are many more medical schools to get into. But in those days, it was a very fierce competition. But I think being in a big city, I grew up in Mumbai, helped me because I went to school in a city where there were medical schools. So I had an idea of what it could be like. So,
and
yes.
Did you go to a private or a public school?
Public school. I've never been to any private institution. So, and I've always worked in a public sector institution as well throughout my life.
So that's, I think, from what I know, that's doubly hard, doubly competitive.
Yes, it is very
so
competitive indeed. Yeah.
Very, very impressive. So then when you did your early training and your medical education in India, but now you're here. So
yes,
how did that work out?
So I can't say it was very planned. So after I finished my MBBS, so my undergraduate medical degree, I decided to specialize in psychiatry. I had always been interested, again, very early on in my medical school, I just became fascinated with psychiatry. So I did my MD in psychiatry, so the postgraduate degree where you go through a residency training and become a psychiatrist. I did that in Mumbai as well. And then during the course of doing my MD, I got married. And my husband was in touch with some friends in the UK and they encouraged him to apply to come to the UK to study further. And so it wasn't part of my initial plan, but neither did I think that I wanted to stay apart from my husband. So I decided to accompany him. And what I had very much wanted to do at the time, which wasn't always possible, was to specialize in working with children and young people. So I wanted to become a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And in India, at that time, it was not possible. I mean, I think there were one or two institutions where you didn't exactly get a degree, but you could get some experience. And I wasn't in a position to travel to other parts of the country. So I decided that I would come to the UK and specialize in child and adolescent psychiatry if possible. So that's how the plans were made. And it was originally meant to be a short-term tenure in the UK, do my training, higher training, specialist training, and go back. But then things, one thing led to another. So I remained in the UK and became a British citizen and pursued my career here.
Gosh, so was it difficult to get a job and to redesign your life in the UK?
I mean, it was very tough in the beginning. In fact, when I hear talk about international medical graduates and locally employed doctors now, it just takes me back to my early days, because I came to this country as a locally employed doctor. I did not come in under national terms and conditions of service. And I came in with a two-year contract, which was dependent on my employer at the time. So I think I was very scared initially, partly because I had never traveled outside the country before. I mean, you know, all those things, the getting onto a plane, traveling on my own because my husband came before me, and then having to enter an institution like the NHS, which I just didn't know anything about, was so scary because you had to be two things at once. I mean, on the one hand, I was a very experienced, well, I had finished my training in psychiatry and had worked for a year in India, but here I came and I was just treated like a novice, and I was, you know, expected to be a student again. So it was tough. And I think the way I was treated, it wasn't uniformly supportive, let's say. So I've had my experiences and my share of being discriminated against. And I think for me, that combination, you know, I always talk about intersectionality, but that combination of being an international medical graduate, I was called a foreigner by many, many people. So being a foreigner, being a woman, and being a person of color, I think just those intersection of factors meant that I was at the receiving end of some, very critical or pejorative comments, and just being thought of as not good enough. So it was a steep learning curve.
Can you give some examples just to sort of bring that to life? I mean, nothing that don't feel comfortable saying, but just to bring it to life a bit.
Yeah. So everything from, so when I first started working in the country, now, you know, I covered many hospitals and bases, so it isn't about any one person or team. But without my permission, my name was shortened to Anne Dave. Now, my surname is Dave and my first name is Ananta. But I was just called Anne Dave because people thought it was acceptable to just shorten it because they found it difficult to pronounce Ananta. So I just felt that I was being forced to become somebody else, that I couldn't be who I was. And there were many times when, you know, people didn't want to call me anything at all. So rather than talking to me or addressing me or looking at me, they just ignored me. So that was one bit, I think, which is about the accepting people who come from abroad, from another culture, who speak differently. So there was, I think, you know, it is still existent in the NHS, I'm sorry to say, even though we've progressed to the extent where we can talk about it. I liken it to xenophobia almost, where there is, you know, this reluctance and this automatic assumption or discrimination against people they look on as foreigners. And as a woman, I was very often asked about things like, I think common to many people, whether I would stop working soon because I wanted to get pregnant, whether, and in you know, an assumption about my culture, I was asked things like, did my husband give me permission to work? You know, how did I manage both work and home? And, things around my in-laws, did your wider family give you permission to work and to come to another country? And when there were times when I used to be upset, because obviously if some people have been, say, rude to me or unacceptably abusive to me in terms of language, whether it was by patients or colleagues, I was called unacceptable terms. And when that upset me, of course, the assumption, automatic assumption was that, of course, I'm a foreign born female new to this country. So I'm going to be emotional. And let's just give her time to calm down because, you know, she's weak. So a combination of comments, actions, of commission and omission, the phrases used, the assumptions made about my, about my commitment and about my ability because I was a female and a person of color. So I think if you look at those intersections, they, you know, you come rather very low down the hierarchy. So whether it was about, you know, and even everyday things like going out, for instance, in the evenings after work, there would be get-togethers in a pub, for example, and I don't drink and I didn't know enough about pop cultures. So when I expressed reluctance, sometimes people would laugh at me. Sometimes people would say, oh, does it mean you don't have permission to come to a pub? Does it mean that, you know, you can't wear certain dresses? Or I remember wearing very traditional dresses sometimes to go out in the evenings, and comments would be made about how I had dressed and did I not know how to wear, you know, some informal Western dresses. So it was a range of things, Jane, which both at work and in my personal life, which led to some really difficult situations. And even afterwards, a few years after I came to the country, I became pregnant with my first child. I have two children. And when I sought help in hospitals, both my children were born premature and I suffered some complications. I had to be in hospital. My children had to be in intensive care. So I have to say several assumptions made in terms of my culture, my race, spoken to very rudely and not taken seriously when I was complaining about pain or about needing help or about, you know, some help about how to sort of start breastfeeding, for example. So it has been over the years. But I have to say that, you know, even the one or two people who showed me kindness, who showed me a different way, that made me hold on to, you know, my desire to continue being a doctor and to continue working and to combine work and motherhood and family. So a fair few negative experiences.
So presumably you were also on your own, because one of the things that helps women to survive through the whole childbearing and working, what have you, is to have, like I do now, to have a granny around the corner to come and pick up the pieces.
Absolutely. I mean, it was my husband and myself. We didn't have any family in the UK. I mean, now we've got more of a social network and, you know, a friend circle and a sense of belonging. But in those days, we were still fairly new. We were still fairly new to the UK and we were still developing our confidence. So we were very isolated. I still remember, you know, my husband got a call when he was at work because I'd just gone for a routine antenatal checkup and I was told I had to get admitted to hospital and baby possibly born. And my husband getting a call at work to say, look, you're about to become a father. Just get here. And he was so shocked. And there was nobody who could turn to or do anything. He just came rushing to hospital. And we wanted to get one of our parents here just to support me. And the visa application process was very difficult. They really couldn't get here. But in the end, some, you know, a kind person helped us, did a letter, an emergency medical letter to say that, I mean, my baby was quite unwell. I was unwell in hospital, to say that on medical grounds, please grant this family a visa, you know, as soon as possible. So somebody was able to come, you know, my mother-in-law was able to come a few days after my baby was born. But at first, in the first instance, it was very tough. So we faced all those barriers, being alone and not able to get family here.
And at that stage, were you still on a series of short-term contracts or had you got onto a training program?
I had. So a few months after coming to the country, we were just exploring what the possibilities were and what we could do. I was very much interested, as I said, in pursuing child and adolescent psychiatry if I could, and specializing in it. So we asked around and, you know, as I said, there were a few people who helped us, who were kind to us. So we got in touch with the training program director in Birmingham at the time. I mean, I have to take his name. He's been extremely supportive, Professor Chitra Mohan, who is an old age psychiatrist, now retired. And this was going back, you know, around 25 years now. So we asked about how we could apply to get onto the training scheme. I mean, Birmingham was the nearest because I'd come to the Black Country initially and the Birmingham scheme was a big one. So I thought my husband and I both had a chance of getting in if we applied and we got through. So yes, we were lucky. We made the applications. We went through the round of interviews and we got accepted onto a training scheme and I trained. So I had to do my training all over again, although I'd done my MD in India. So I did my, I think in those days it was called SHO and registrar, specialist registrar, I think, when I was training. So we went through the training scheme. I passed my membership examinations and then got onto the specialist register as a child and adolescent psychiatrist.
Wow, goodness me, what a story. So do you think did it take you longer than it must have done because you had to play a bit of snakes and ladders and go back down to the bottom and come up again?
Yes, I mean, I think the good thing was that because of my experience in India, I was able to take my exams, I think, 6 months earlier. So we were given a 6-month exemption in recognition of the fact that we had done psychiatry previously. I'd done 4 years already of psychiatry in India. So I was able to take my exams earlier. And the very good thing also was that I was able to pass both my exams the first time. So I managed to clear the exams at the shortest possible time. And although I did take time out for maternity leave, I was was able to get onto a training scheme while I was on maternity leave and start when I came out of maternity leave. So it was just, you know, I think fortuitous coincidence that I was able to catch up. So under the circumstances, I was able to do it as quickly as possible. But yes, I've trained in psychiatry for double the amount of time that people would normally train.
And so when you got your CCT, do you think it was more difficult for you to get consultant posts? I mean, you're working where you trained. Did that might have helped, perhaps, because they knew
It helped to some extent, but there were also rules around. I wasn't a British citizen at the time. I had a visa which allowed me to, you know, I think I had to do the applications to change from a training visa to a work permit. But there were, so not only was it a barrier in terms of competing against local candidates, but it was the visa and the legal procedures as well. So I had to go through all that. And in fact, I was very thankful when I got the job. So I did apply in one of the local hospitals where I trained. I trained in quite a few locally. So I did apply in one of them, and I was very lucky to have got the job. After a series of struggles and hassles and having to pass my ARCP while I was on my maternity leave with my second child.
Gosh. And it sounds, well, I mean, you're the expert in your career, but it sounds as if you got there, but it doesn't seem to have taken long before you actually realised you were a bit more ambitious and needed extra stuff to do. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, it seems to have, I would say it sort of crept upon me in an incremental way rather than being very planned. So I would say for the first few years as a consultant, I kept my head down. I worked less than full time, and I was trying to manage very young children, on calls, family, home, you know, the usual thing that we all, many of us do. So I didn't really think beyond the confines of working as a consultant. I just wanted to make sure I did my job well and got home. But I slowly started, I suppose I started becoming more curious about what lies beneath the work, what lies beneath our decision making, how do we actually, you know, make the decisions we do, how do we address issues of inequalities. I didn't call it health inequalities then, but I realized back from that time, I was really interested in how different people were treated differently, how they had different access to patient care, and as colleagues, that different people were treated differently as well. So I think I started becoming interested in these things. So I started small, and in each of these cases, I did not start with the intention of it leading to anything bigger. But I think for me, that's been the seminal lesson, if you like, of my life, that if you want to aim for something big, you don't have to straight away aim for something. You can start in very small incremental steps, which ultimately get you there. But a common thread amongst all the things that I have done was really being very curious and interested and feeling very sad about inequalities that exist in our society. And so I started off by, firstly, I realized in my work as a child and adolescent psychiatrist that mothers with mental health problems were discriminated against in terms of how they were thought of as good parents or not. And mothers from an ethnic minority background or those who had no settled status in the country were discriminated even further. So I started working in...
Well, when you say discriminated... How did you know that? What did that mean?
So, for example, I would attend safeguarding meetings. So I was a child and adolescent psychiatrist. So there were children who were on a child in need register or a child protection register. And I would attend initial child protection conferences. And I would see over a couple of years, I really looked at the differential outcomes for parents from different backgrounds, either cultural backgrounds or without mental illness. And it seemed as if, it was about whether the parent was considered to be a good enough parent. So when it was a person from what I would call a background of relative privilege, now we have to understand that when a child is, you know, a child protection order or a mother has a mental illness, it's not a privileged position. It's all relative in our society. So I could see that the outcomes were different. So either the child would be stepped down from the child protection register or would be considered safe to go back to parents, or you know, there would be a different diagnosis. The child would not go down the criminal justice route. They would go down the health and welfare route. So the outcomes were different. The way people were treated, so the way their accounts were believed, were different. So people who were not from a white or an English-speaking background did not have their accounts believed at first glance. So there was an automatic assumption of the worst possible interpretation or a worst-case scenario, and they were adversely judged. They weren't given the reasonable adjustments which would allow them to get their points across in an equal way. So there were so many ways in which I felt they were discriminated. And so I actually found myself, you know, sometimes acting as interpreter and advocate for some of these people, because I could see how unequal their treatment was. And slowly I got interested in that work. And the first time I put myself forward, I think, was when the trust I was working in at the time was setting up a clinical ethics committee to look at how decisions are made. What is ethical decision making, whether it is for a patient, a colleague, or, you know, service or whatever. So I said that I wanted to be one of the founder members. So I put myself forward and I was interviewed, got onto this committee, and that changed my life. Again, I have to mention Professor Deidre Kelly. She was the person who set up the committee at the time at Birmingham Children's Hospital, and she's been a huge ally. So at each point, she pushed me. She would say, Anantha, why are you not going for this? Why don't you consider putting yourself for this? She encouraged me to apply for chair of the ethics committee a few years later, and I became the chair of the, you know, ethics committee at Children's Hospital. So that, you know, that was the first time I put myself forward. So it was over a period of years, of course. I became a founder member, then went on to become chair. Then I got into, so again, another first role that I took on was about as the name doctor for child safeguarding. So this mm-hmm. was in the wake of Baby P, and the Children Act had been revised, and the new act named and required named individuals to be established or developed by each organization. So in our trust as well, where I was working, they were looking for a named doctor for child safeguarding. And this was a very new role. Nobody knew anything about it. So I decided, but because I'd been doing all this work, as I said, you know, I'd become aware of all these issues, I decided to put myself forward for the role of named doctor for child safeguarding. And I was able to do some good work there. So I think based on all these, and I decided to do public engagement, you know, demystifying the language of mental illness to the common public, because it could be very jargonistic, you know, very laden with technical terms. And I felt that, you know, the common, you know, people, the lay public had to understand what it is that we were saying in a language that made sense to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to engage. So I got involved with the Royal College, you know, in the business of doing talks in various languages. I can speak six languages. So I did talks in various languages and went out to communities and faith leaders talking about child mental health problems, maternal mental health, etc. So that is how I got involved in doing things which were beyond my consultant role. So each of these were relatively new areas which others hadn't explored. And that led me exactly 10 years ago in 2013, I applied for my for a clinical director post. I was encouraged by what I had done. And I thought, okay, I'm really interested in improving quality of care. I'm interested in working with patients and carers, and I'm interested in having that, what I see now as a quality improvement approach to things. So wow. That is when I first got into medical management 10 years ago.
Okay, and you've been working there ever since?
And not in moved, the same trust, not in but, the same trust.
But you moved relatively recently to this chief medical officer role.
Yes. So after I worked as a clinical director for 5 years, I was appointed medical director in a trust in Lincolnshire Partnership, NHS Foundation Trust. So I went from clinical director to medical director of a trust, and now chief medical officer for a system. And which, I mean, the ICSs were only established last year. So I became the CMO when they were first established in the Black Country.
So actually quite the pioneer. And one of the things that's really interesting is that in listening to what you say and the way that you say it, and I may have this wrong. You're the psychiatrist, not me. But you haven't got angry or resentful. You've just sort of rolled your sleeves up and thought, goodness me, this needs sorting.
Yes,
I think that's quite a female thing. That this just needs to be sorted out.
I very much think so. And, you know, I think each of us react differently. So I don't think I could ever sit on judgment on those who felt angry. They have every right. But I felt personally that getting angry was a negative waste of energy, that it channels our energy in the wrong direction. Or for some people, it might be entirely different, that anger fuels them. But for me, it was always a case of, I think, coming to a consensus, finding common ground, and, you know, reaching out and being compassionate. And I think if you do that, you get treated better in return. So I tried to not get bitter. Firstly, it's not how I work. But also, secondly, in a strange way, I felt that it would be a handing victory on a platter to those who sought to undermine me if I became angry or upset or gave up. I just wanted to show to people that people from different backgrounds, different cultures, different abilities can actually be leaders and do things and change things. And I think as I developed in my career, I also sort of became aware, maybe rather in a very surprised way, that I was perhaps seen as somebody, you know, as a role model, or as somebody whom people could come to seek advice, as a mentor. And this was a shock to me. I mean, now I see it. But in those initial years when people would say, can you tell me how you became a clinical director or a medical director? I would say, oh, yes, actually, people actually want to know. And I very, very firmly believe in the words of Maya Angelou. I always remember her saying, and she said that all of us who've risen to these high positions, if we've been given the gift of freedom, our role is to set others free. Yeah. And, you know, you have to do that. You've got to nurture the next generation, be there as, you know, the one who helps them climb the ladder. So it's something that I feel is my biggest role at the moment, being able to nurture the next generation and support colleagues. Because alongside all this, Jane, I mean, while I was interested in developing services and seeing whether I could offer my services as a leader, is the one thing that I became aware of is that you cannot have good quality care if you do not look after the people who deliver the care. Yeah. So that is the other aspect of my work that I've really become involved in. So one was around addressing equalities and inequalities and promoting equity across for both services, patients, and staff. But the other thing was also about the welfare of the workforce, and especially as a psychiatrist, mental illness amongst doctors and how it can be so hidden. So both these twin things really have been the driving forces. And I feel in that way, if I can make a difference to the next generation or even support colleagues to develop themselves, I'll be paying it forward.
Fantastic. Well, that's such a great mantra to work by. Somebody once told me about feeling resentful about things that have been done wrong to you, is that it's like eating poison and hoping the other person's going to die. And so I'm sure I think that was meant to be Saint Augustine, apparently. Oh, okay. That said that, so an older and so I'm sure you're right in moving on and then trying to spread good things to the next generation. So during all of this, you've mentioned some of the barriers and some of the difficulties that you've had. Have you had particularly positive, high, wonderful experiences as you go through? Is there anything you want to share?
I mean, I think for me, the biggest positive thing I want to say is about my experience of mentors, allies, and sponsors. That's been, and I wouldn't have done it on my own. I wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. So I think even when I was struggling, even when I was at a stage when I was thinking, really, can I go on with this? Can I continue combining work and family life? And can I actually get past these barriers of, you know, automatic assumptions and discrimination and being ignored, you know, as if I don't exist? I had at every stage at least one person tell me, Anantha, I know you're capable of more. Don't let that get to you. I think, you know, I'll help you prepare for the interview. Why don't you apply for this? I think you're really good at this. Will you help me do? So I think that made a huge difference. So my positive experiences, I've already mentioned two people. So many others. When I was first thinking of going into my medical management role, I had Professor Bhomik. He's no more, but he was, he's done many things. He was a chair of the Faculty of Intellectual Disability at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He was a medical director, training program director, an honorary fellow of the Royal College. So he was a really senior person who used his privilege very wisely and compassionately. And I've learned a lot from him. And when I'm struggling in some situation about doing the right thing, I ask myself, what would Professor Bhoumik have done? I call it the Professor B test. And, you know, because he was so very generous with his wisdom and experience and his, you know, his time for others. So he encouraged me hugely. So these were people who gave of themselves very selflessly, I think, and were able to spot the potential in me even when I doubted myself or I was feeling down. So, and as I progressed in my career, I mean, I've had huge support from the Royal College of Psychiatrists. I have to mention Dr. Adrian James, who was the immediate past president of the Royal College. Again, he encouraged me to apply for the Churchill Fellowship, which I was awarded in 2019. And the topic of my fellowship was suicide prevention in doctors. But I did it because he encouraged me. You know, people like Sharon O'Donnell, who set up Suicide Bereavement UK. She's been a huge influence because of the work she's done in suicide bereavement. I was encouraged, not directly, but I was inspired by Professor Michael Rutter to do more in child psychiatry. I mean, as I sat my exams and as I thought of how difficult it was to combine specialist training while having a baby, I would see the work that he'd done, the span of his work and how he changed the face of child psychiatry. And I would think, we can make a difference to young people, babies, right at the start of their lives. Fantastic. And that's a huge privilege. So these are people who've influenced me. And so that's been a really positive influence. And, you know, I went on because of their support in spite of huge barriers. And I face them even today. I mean, even today in a room, people either don't take my name. So everyone else in the room is addressed by name and I'm called, "Hi there," when I sit in a room. It was very recently I went to a conference and it was a high profile conference. I won't name which one. And there was a lounge for speakers. And I was told I could sit there and have a cup of coffee. And somebody said, "Excuse me, this is for speakers only." And I said, I'm a speaker. And they got such a shock. And, you know, they just assumed I couldn't be a speaker. So, you know, you face it all the time. But you remember those people who have supported you, the good work that you can do. And that if it is like this for me at this senior stage in my career, what it must be like for people who are just starting out.
Absolutely right. So just a couple of questions. I want to come along to the end now. So being a successful woman doctor is a tall ask. Also having a successful husband who's who's working in the same area as you know, your husband is also a psychiatrist.
Yes.
How has that impacted or influenced your life, your family life, your children?
So it's a tale of two halves, I think. So for the first half of my career, I focused on being there for my family and not putting myself forward beyond my usual duties in terms of work. And Subodh, who is the Dean of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, was very, very focused right from the beginning. I could see he could go far. So, you know, I was happy to support him. But I have to say he's been incredibly supportive of me. He's encouraged me every step of the way. And he's been, I think perhaps he's taken more pleasure in the way I've developed than even myself. So I think we were able to come to a happy medium arrangement where, you know, we did what we, each of us, felt comfortable doing at the time and never stood as a barrier to one another and encouraged one another. And I think the secret of it is we never worked in the same organization. So that is good. We developed our own different parts.
The children?
The children. Well, I've got, you know, we've got two adult daughters and one of them is in medicine. She's a doctor in training. So I like to think that my husband and I encourage her about the possibilities. And what I say to people is that, you know, every path is very unique and different. And a different path is by no means a lesser path. And a delayed path is by no means a lesser path.
Yeah.
So you've got to work out your own way of doing things and the pace at which you do things. But you know, start small, take up opportunities. So hopefully she's getting the message. She's a very grounded, sensible young person. And my younger one, she's not got into medicine, but I just admire her spirit and her love of life and what she's doing. And I learn a lot from her. I learn a lot from my children, actually.
Fantastic. So advice to aspiring women leaders who want to be like you, Ananta?
The advice is there isn't a substitute for learning the ropes the hard way, you know, getting adjusted and getting to know something, whether it's a system, a culture, a team. So there aren't any shortcuts, but failure or a setback or somebody not believing in you is not a reason to give up. And every little step counts. I mean, you know, I've done one marathon in my life and I know how hard it is. It's a very slow marathon, but I would never have been able to do it if I had focused directly on getting to 26.2 miles. You've got to look at the next step. So I think each step counts, and anything you can do, however small, counts, because it shapes you as a person. And even if there is one mentor or ally that, you know, who believes in you or who encourages you, be with that person, because you do need to surround yourself with people who see the best potential in you and who make you feel good about what you're able to offer. So I think surround yourself with an ally or mentor. Be part of a network. I think for me, having become a part of BIPA, the British Indian Psychiatric Association, and I'm its immediate past president, has really given me a huge network where I'm able to interact with others and celebrate being British Indian. So allyship, network, having a sense of belonging, taking small steps, not giving up. But also for me, there is something about authenticity, Jane. And I think for many years, what I struggled with was whether I'm British enough or Indian enough to please everyone around me. And, you know, you get to this thing about, I felt to be accepted in this society, I had to somehow submerge my Indian heritage and be more British. And that's not going to work, because you have to be who you are. You have to be able to, you know, see yourself as a fully rounded person, celebrating your heritage and your roots. So now I'm more at peace because I celebrate the full aspect, the two aspects of my identity, being British and Indian. How to be both is my mantra. And I encourage people to do that. I submerged it for many years. I want people coming in now to be able to celebrate all aspects of their identity right from the beginning. So that's what I would say to people.
Fantastic. That's really, really wise advice. Thank you so much, Ananta, for talking to me today. I'm sure that the listeners will be inspired by your story. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.